am Bex Dillon and welcome to this podcast, Conversations on Faith and Equality. In today's podcast, I got to speak to Hope Virgo. Hope is a mental health campaigner. She's the author of a book called Stand Tall, Little Girl, Facing Up to Anorexia. And she is a public speaker and she speaks in lots of schools and workplaces about the issue of eating disorders. And in today's podcast, we hear from her own experience of anorexia and the struggle and recovery that she's gone through, but also the passion that she has for it. And I was shocked to know that the highest mortality rate for any mental illness is eating disorders. So it is actually a huge problem that affects 13% of men screened and 19% of women screened. So it's a large number of people that are affected by this problem. And Hope feels passionate about getting the resources and help that people need. So for people that might find this triggering, just think it's, just want to give you a warning, this is what the podcast is about. But I hope that this will be helpful for people to hear her story, to hear how she has come through it and is the other side of it, and the work and the advocacy that she does on these issues. So here you go, and I hope you enjoy listening to this. I hope, thank you so much for doing this. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast, and so excited to hear you talk about some things that you feel really passionate about. And I know that you've written a book and you've got a campaign called Drop the Scales, and you're a real advocate on eating disorders. And I wondered if you could just tell us a bit about your story and how that sort of started, how you became the sort of advocate for those things.
Thanks so much for having me on. Like, it's so wonderful to be here. So I developed anorexia when I was about 12, 13 years old. And I'd always kind of struggled with my emotions growing up, really struggled to kind of process things in the right way, and was always kind of trying to look for a kind of quick fix to my emotions. Alongside kind of the struggle with emotions, my family life was quite hectic, quite dysfunctional in places. And I really just wanted to try and fix like every single thing that was going on around me, and fix kind of the arguments, fix the discussions, and just couldn't really do that. And put a lot of that pressure on myself, I think, growing up as well. And then I could think like it kind of all came to kind of, the starting point was following 8 months of sexual abuse. I again was kind of sitting with a lot of those emotions that I just did not know what to do with them.
And that was when you were sort of 11, 12, was it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And I felt so out of my control in that situation. And I also felt like I couldn't talk to anyone about it. So I was trying to just like find other ways to control what was going on, other ways to numb those emotions. And for me, that came out in the form of food restriction and obsessive exercise. And it was quite literally like just having this voice in my head all the time. It told me what I should eat, what I should drink, and how much exercise I should do. And every time I did what it told me to do, I just felt absolutely amazing. And it gave me this real kind of purpose and value back in my life, whilst numbing the emotions and giving me that sense of control. And looking back, like it definitely served a purpose and gave me this kind of comfort and security over what felt like a really, really challenging situation to navigate, and one that I felt so unsafe in. It just kept me going.
Did anyone know at the time that you were being abused? Did any of your family or anyone?
No. So I think my mum had her kind of suspicions, but we didn't talk about it at all. And I guess me and my mum we don't really have that relationship where we talk about kind of that sort of thing anyway. And we didn't growing up. And so I don't think it was something that we ever really wanted to bring forward. And I think for me, like, there was so much shame around it that it meant that I felt like there was something really the matter with me and there was something wrong with me. And I was so worried that if people found out about it, then actually they'd think there was something definitely wrong with me. So they'd have like all of these thoughts and judgments around me. So I kept it secret actually up until I was about probably just before I turned 18. And that was when it then kind of all came out into the open and began to get looked into. But at that point, I wasn't well enough to really do much about it, and only started speaking openly about it probably about 4 years ago. When I went to the police with it about kind of, I think my mum wanted me to do it, and I felt like it was probably the right time to try and get some closure around everything that had happened.
And did anything happen after you went to the police? Was the person convicted?
No, so I went through a court process, but unfortunately there wasn't enough evidence. So I think for me, like, at that point, I was really frustrated with the system. I felt like I'd been massively let down.
Yeah.
But I've managed to get to a place since then where I'm not really angry about it anymore. I've kind of accepted it, and I've realised that I don't need to be angry about it anymore. I don't need to control my food intake or my exercise and things like that as a coping mechanism, which for me, I think actually having gone through that whole process, not feeling heard and then finding other ways to feel heard, now I've kind of done a bit of a 360. And I feel like I can kind of move on from it, and I don't need to let it kind of define my, like, who I am or my future as well.
Such an awful thing to go through though at such a young age as well.
Yeah, it was really difficult. And I think, like, I'd spent a lot of my kind of childhood, I guess, after it happened, trying to own my sexuality and trying to numb a lot of the stuff that was going on. And I think because of that, I was obviously trying to find those other coping mechanisms. And I think so often with stuff like abuse, like, you find those coping mechanisms and they serve a purpose for a little bit, but it's not helping you. And in a way, you're kind of destructing a lot of the time and along the way, because you just want to feel safe and secure and like you're good enough, like there's nothing the matter with you. And the eating disorder, like, did all of that for me as well.
So when did you sort of realise that it was an eating disorder? Did you know that from kind of straight away, or did that take a while?
No, so I hid it from everyone around me for about 4 years. And eventually my school got in touch with my mum. I think they'd noticed kind of odd behaviours around food at lunchtimes and things like that. So I went to my GP, and then I was referred to the Children's Adolescent Mental Health Services. And I remember, like, even in my second appointment, when they diagnosed me, I was just sitting there thinking, like, you guys have no idea. Like, you don't understand what's going on. I don't have this thing the matter with me. And I think at that point, I was just so convinced that to have an eating disorder, you had to look a certain way. You had to hate food, like, not eat anything. And I just couldn't get my head around it. I was like, you know what? I really like food when I allow myself to have it. Like, I do eat and I don't look like I'm underweight. And so for me, I just wasn't able to accept that anything was the matter with me. And I spent about 6 months as an outpatient, kind of going every week, kind of pretending like things were okay. But I do know that over that 6 month period, like, things were getting really difficult, and my days had turned into, like, these massive family arguments in the morning around breakfast, and then going into school for, like, a little bit if I felt like it, trying really hard to be engaged, but just constantly thinking about food and calories and exercise. And by the evenings, I was just, like, emotionally and physically just exhausted by what was going on. And I hated it. I hated how it made me feel in those evenings. And I remember, like, the evenings when I would just be kind of sitting there in bed and I'd, like, reflect on the day. I'm one of these people that just constantly is reflecting and probably overthinking all the time. And because of that, I remember just lying there trying to kind of work it all out. And every evening I'd be like, tomorrow I'm just going to be okay. Like, something's going to change. Something's going to click. I'm going to be like everyone else. It's all going to be fine. But the next morning I'd always get up and I'd weigh myself. I'd look in the mirror and I just feel like I can't do this. Like, my brain just would not let me start. And I was only able to accept that I was unwell on my third day when I was in kind of living in an inpatient unit. And they got me to do this like activity where they got me to draw how I imagined myself looking. So the kind of thing you do when you're like a toddler. And then they got me to lie down on the same piece of paper and they traced around my body. And I then had to stand up and look back down at it. And it was in that moment that I realized that, like, the way that I viewed myself was so, so distorted. And there was, like, seriously something the matter with my brain.
Wow.
And kind of since then, I think I've kind of unpacked a lot of that kind of body image and body distortion stuff. And I now know that it kind of equated a lot to kind of a fear of rejection and abandonment and judgment. But actually at the time, I wasn't really aware of that. But it was just that kind of evidence that I needed to just start to think, actually, do you know what? I'm just going to start eating. I'm just going to see what will happen.
So by that stage, you were in as an inpatient in the hospital.
Yeah, I ended up being admitted after 6 months at outpatients. There wasn't anything that outpatients could do for me. And I think by that point, the illness was just completely taken over me. I was convinced I was still in control, but I definitely wasn't. And yeah, by the time I got admitted, I didn't really have a choice about it. It was kind of, you go in or they'll probably section me. So I was like, right, I'll just go in. And it was weird, like looking back, I was convinced that I'd be in and out within about 2 weeks. And I had like a bunch of flowers that someone brought me, but like when I went into treatment, and I was like, oh, it's fine. Like, they're not going to die before I leave. Like, I'll take them home. But I ended up spending a year kind of living in an inpatient unit, trying to kind of recover and get better, I guess.
And is that sort of having therapy and them working on what you're eating? What's it sort of like being an inpatient?
Yeah, so I was in like a general mental health hospital, like, and not an eating disorder specific one, which actually for me, I think worked really, really well. Eating disorders are like such competitive illnesses.
Yeah.
That I think like, had I been in kind of just an eating disorder unit, I would have probably constantly been in that kind of like competition zone. But we basically had the same structure every day. So kind of get up at 7 a.m, we'd get weighed. We'd then have breakfast at 8, and they'd give us like a 20-minute window to eat our breakfast. And then throughout the day, you'd have like snacks, meals, kind of bits of therapy if you were well enough. But you had to be like a certain way through your recovery and kind of starting to eat a little bit more before you could start doing therapy. And then if you were well enough, so kind of 6-7 months into my time in treatment, I did start doing bits of schoolwork as well, which actually gave me something to do. I think quite often when you're in like an inpatient unit, a lot of the time you are sitting around, like watching telly, trying to read, things like that. But for me, it really helped. Actually, I think just going back to that structure and having that kind of set format in place. So therapy wise, I did a lot of like one-to-one therapy. We tried to do a little bit of family therapy, but didn't really work with my kind of family setup. But the bit of therapy that I literally am like, every hospital, everyone should be doing this therapy, was like the most basic form of therapy I've ever done. And after every single mealtime, every person with an eating disorder used to go into the room next door and we would just talk about the food. And it sounds ridiculous and like so basic, but for us, it gave us the chance to just remove all of that emotion around the food and be like, I've eaten that meal. I feel like a failure. I feel really guilty. I'm still struggling. I don't want people to think that I'm okay because I'm eating. And just having that space to really voice those emotions and express yourself. I think so often with eating disorders, we think they're kind of about weight and body image and food. But quite often for people, it's like a way of expressing themselves. So as soon as we start giving people that space to express themselves, it can help alleviate some of those symptoms.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I wanted to ask you actually how, because it seems like there is quite, there are some stereotypes of like, these are what eating disorders, and there's also some kind of misunderstanding, or maybe people who not, maybe fear of those who do have it. And so wonder if you could just sort of, if you were to explain to someone what an eating disorder is, how you would sort of explain it.
Yeah, so I totally agree with what you just said. I think there is so much stigma around eating disorders, and we all have those kind of images in our head of someone with an eating disorder. But my explanation would be eating disorders are mental illnesses. They are not just a diet that someone goes through. They're not a phase. They're not something that someone can grow out of. They're not a choice. 50 to 60% of people who have anorexia have a genetic predisposition to developing an eating disorder.
Oh, wow.
And for people with binge eating disorder, it's I think it's between 60 and 70% who have that predisposition kind of genetic aspect as well. We know that in other cases, eating disorders are often caused by trauma. So that doesn't have to be an abuse. It could literally be, getting bullied. It could be the pandemic. It could be anything that's traumatic to that individual. But they're a way of expressing themselves. They're not about the food, they're not about the weight, but they're a way to be heard, a way to numb a lot of emotions. And they're an unhealthy coping mechanism for life, basically. So for me, obviously, it was my coping mechanism around the abuse. But from other people I've spoken to, it's their coping mechanism to maybe kind of heighten situations where life feels really, really uncertain and really difficult.
Yeah, because one of the things I think is like, is what makes people have like a healthy relationship with food, because there are some people who wouldn't describe themselves with eating disorder. I don't even know if other people would describe themselves with eating disorders, but easy to be slightly obsessed with food and exercise. And whether there's sort of, it's like a sort of sliding scale, or it's a sort of binary thing, you know, you do have it or you don't have it. Because it, you know, even I was talking to my husband last night, and I was like, are you happy for me to say this? But when we first met, he was like really into the gym, took a lot of exercise and weighed his food. And if he ate too much, he would be sick. And he thought that was a really normal way of being. I was like, that's not normal to throw up after a meal if you feel like you've eaten too much. But in his head, he was like, I don't have an eating disorder. I'm just trying to look good. But it was a sort of, and now he's like stopped that and got a much healthier relationship with food. I'm like, does that, you know, where does the sort of line come in? Because there's so much sort of diet culture, you know, we've all got to look a certain way. And where that kind of switches from, you know, where we're healthy, where we're not that healthy, but it's not an eating disorder, and where it kind of moves over and it does become an eating disorder.
Yeah. And I always think of it like we're all on some kind of continuum of our own relationship with our bodies and with our food. And at one end, we have like the healthy eating, we have body acceptance, we have healthy weight for height, all of that sort of stuff. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we have like eating disorders, so bulimia, anorexia, binge eating disorder, any kind of illness that we would categorize within that. And then I think the majority of people sit in the middle spectrum, which I always think is kind of like a bit of a red zone, a bit of a red flag that something's not quite right. And that could be the kind of yo-yo dieting, the obsession with exercise, the kind of eating too much and then making themselves sick. And if you fall anywhere in that line, then I'm like, that's a red flag that something's not quite right. Mm. And I think it's really, really difficult nowadays, because I do think that across like society generally, and all over the world, actually, like eating disorder culture has been totally normalized. Like we all normalize like discussing what we've eaten on a day-to-day basis, or like even over the last couple of months with the pandemic, like we're all talking about lockdown weight and how we're going to shift weight. And we put so much value on what we look like and what we're eating. And it's just not right. And I think because of that, a lot of people who are struggling with food just kind of slip under the radar and maybe don't realize that anything's the matter. And I think particularly if you've done that behavior for such a long time, it becomes totally normalized. And in situations, I guess, when you're going to the gym a lot more and maybe you are obsessing over exercise, again, we're complimenting people who are like that, who are moving more. So it creates like quite a dangerous narrative as well. So actually when I do a lot of work in schools, and quite often when I'm in schools, I'm like, guys, if you're in that red zone, like you need to do something about it. Like you need to kind of readdress your own relationship with food and move out of having that disordered relationship with it.
And how do you do that? How do you have move out of that and have a healthy relationship with food?
It's so hard. And it is really difficult. And I guess I want to emphasize just quickly that not everyone who's in that disordered spectrum and who maybe goes on a diet or calorie counts will develop an eating disorder. So if you're listening, like, don't be panicking about someone that you know, perhaps. But I think for me, it's like making sure that you are flooding yourself with the right content. So if you currently get your diet advice or your fitness advice off places like Instagram, like actually maybe have a little bit of a rethink about that, because a lot of that information isn't scientifically valid, but for some reason we're believing it and we're kind of creating those rules for ourselves in our head. The other thing that I would recommend doing, which is something that I do quite a bit actually, is write a list of every single food rule that I have created and spend like 2 weeks working my way through each rule to try and break it. And it's a bit like an experiment, it's a bit like a trial and error thing. But for me, it's like, so at the start of this year, I had this massive fear around pastries. And so every Friday morning, I'd go out for a pastry and a coffee. And at first, it felt really, really difficult. And I felt really uncomfortable. And I hated it, and was probably like angry for the rest of the day, in all honesty. But by kind of week 4 and 5, it was okay. And now I can go out for a last minute pastry and it doesn't panic me or cause me a lot of that fear. So I think it is about like adding in that variety, adding in those challenges and making sure that you're kind of interrupting any of that negative thinking. I think so often because of the way society is and because we focus so much of our self-worth on our weight and our appearance, it means that quite often people aren't feeling good enough. And so for me, it is like flooding myself with kind of those positive affirmations, like interrupting any of those negative trails of thought and just reminding myself that actually, do you know what? My worth is not defined by my weight. And I think the more we do that sort of stuff, you can just start to slowly change a little bit of a narrative around it. And I think one more kind of final thing is like something, and again, something that I do as well, is trying to, I guess, focus a lot on what I want my future to be like. And one of my drivers for having the pastry is that one day I really want to be able to do that sort of stuff with my kids. I don't want to be a mum that can't get involved and whatever it might be. And so I think thinking about actually what you do want your future to be controlled by. Do you want to have a future where you're kind of constantly having to calorie count or weighing out your food or not able to go for dinner with your friends? Or do you want to have a future where actually you can be totally free from all of this stuff? And is like, if we put so much focus on our future in that sense and make it look like this amazing place, then it just gives you a little bit of a driver to kind of keep every day kind of showing up for yourself and keep taking those steps forward to get to that space where you can also get there.
Yeah, I mean, it's made me think much more about it having a daughter. You know, she's only four, but I think I want her to have a really healthy relationship with food. I mean, say I've got three kids. I want all of them to have a healthy relationship with food, but I feel like there's a lot more pressure from society on women. And I know that actually the document you sent was showing how much it actually affects men as well, which is so surprising because I would think our sort of stereotype is it's a woman's, it's a sort of a young woman's illness rather than it sort of affects everyone. Because it's 13% of men screened have some sort of eating disorder anyway, and 19% of women, which is not a huge difference. I actually, even though I know it affects men, I would have thought that it was a much bigger difference actually. Yeah. And I would have thought for men it's even more hidden sometimes and must be more stigma in admitting that or talking about it without sort of being, I don't know, pretending that it's all okay because it's about a different kind of body image. It's not about being, it might not necessarily be about being really skinny. It might be, like I said with my husband, about being sort of muscly and toned, but it doesn't mean that the sort of mindset isn't the same, really, the sort of obsessive thoughts and control.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think it is so difficult for guys to kind of reach out for support. And I think for me, that's why there still is such a long way to go in getting rid of all of the stigma around eating disorders. Because I do think it is still kind of, seen as something that doesn't affect men as much. And in some situations, I know that like males that I know have gone to their GP presenting with an eating disorder and they've been told that they can't have an eating disorder because they're not a girl. And you're like, that's ridiculous. Like, it's so frustrating. But I think, again, it is like we normalize a lot of those behaviors maybe that present more in men. And actually, I read recently that over lockdown, and there was a study done, it came out probably like, I don't know, 2-3 weeks ago now, which Calm did with Instagram, which showed that actually 48% of men aged 16 to 48 are struggling so much with their body image that it's having a detrimental impact on their mental health. So I think, again, it's like that aspect of it is something that probably needs to start being explored a little bit more to actually open up those conversations and give people that space to actually talk about what's going on and what that might mean for them.
So there must be a strong correlation between people's body image and eating disorder. The two kind of overlap and affect each other. And I wonder if that's something that's sort of some of the problems with our society. Like, if this is such a huge problem, it seems like that not only is like anorexia so serious in the impact that it has, in that it, you know, in terms of mortality, it's the highest mortality rate for psychiatric disease. Is that right?
Yep.
And so it's this huge, like, very serious problem and affecting so many people. Does that say something about our society, that how are we, you know, if whether it's like through social media and this sort of pressure, and, you know, even just you know, what you were saying earlier of the sort of praise that we almost give for people who are in good shape or thin or looking good. It's like, you know, someone came up to me in the park, mum was like, oh, look at you, you're in good shape after having children, I hate you. And sort of pretended like she was joking, but I felt like she genuinely did hate me. There's kind of like, are you praising me or are you attacking me? I'm not quite sure how to take this. Now I feel very aware of my own body through that comment. And but it sort of made me feel like she, you know, she feels a lot of things about her body and being a mum. Like, I see that, you know, having children and the impact that has on the woman's body. There's just, and the pressure that there is, you know, my mum was saying after her and her friends had children, they just wore sort of tent dresses and no one worried about what they looked like. Whereas now they're sort of 6 weeks after, picture on Instagram with, or like in a bikini holding your baby. So don't have any signs that you ever gave birth. And think, how is that possible? When my daughter was saying, I thought you'd had the baby, why do you look pregnant? It takes a while. Okay. That's normal. So it's like, how do we cope with some of these pressures in society? How do we change society if a lot is, you know, what society is telling us to be and look like?
Yeah, so I think firstly, as individuals, like, we need to try and not participate in the diet culture chat. We need to stop complimenting people on weight loss. We need to stop talking about what diet we're on, how many calories we're eating, kind of stop putting that pressure on ourselves, but also on other people as well. And I think as well, like, showing what real bodies are like and making a point to do that. And I think that's something that really frustrates me generally, actually, in society, is the people that we kind of look at on Instagram or on social media, they tend to be kind of two extremes. So you've got people who maybe are like quite like underweight or at a lower weight, and then you've got people who are maybe at a higher weight. And there's nothing really in that kind of middle bracket of people. And I think, again, that then puts pressure on people because people don't know where to fit in. People don't know what they should be looking like or what they should be eating, perhaps. And I think as well, like, as individuals, like, trying to break it down a little bit, like, so, yeah. And, like, I guess being okay going against the grain. So I'm getting married in August and I've got two other friends who are getting married at the same time. And a lot of the conversation is around dieting and how to look good in your wedding dress. And I'm like, am I the only person who is currently not trying to lose weight ahead of my wedding?
Didn't know that was something that you have to think about when you're getting married. It's like number one question, your diet.
It's just ridiculous. I know. And I'm like, but I was speaking the other week, I work with a dietitian, and I was speaking to her about it the other week, and we were saying, like, it's interesting because for me, it's like realizing that actually, why am I so afraid of not going on a diet before I get married? And for me, it always stems back to like the fear of judgment, rejection, abandonment. And then I'm like, oh, maybe if I don't lose weight, no one will want to come to the wedding. No one will have fun at the wedding. And then it's all of those like weird internal dialogues. And I'm like, actually, I don't think that's unique to me. I think that other people have that as well. So perhaps when people do comment on other people's weights, it's because they've got like a deep rooted insecurity that they're failing at life because they're not looking a certain size or they're not shrinking their bodies when they've had a baby and things like that. So I think, yeah, I think as individuals, it's identifying why we're so afraid. What kind of, why are we putting so much emphasis on our body image and on our weight? And then kind of being really proactive in not talking about this sort of stuff, not engaging in it. And I don't think that social media is the kind of completely negative thing, but I think on social media, just creating your feeds in such a way that you're looking at content that actually is inspiring, you're looking at a diverse range of bodies, and we're not normalizing people looking a certain size in a certain shape.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point, is actually the more you look at certain things, like, social media knows what you're looking at, so it just feeds it into you, it starts advertising all those things. So if you can start looking at other things, then you'll get advertised and your feed will change. But I guess the problem is once you start looking at a certain thing, it's like everything then comes at you. And it's part of, you know, what you're saying is the mental health problem of like thoughts in our mind, which doesn't just affect anorexia, but affects all different kinds of mental health. And it feels like now people are talking about it much more, seeing the problem post pandemic. And it is a huge issue, and how we help people who are in those places, whether it is anorexia or any mental health issue, where it's sometimes I think other people think, well, just, you know, just eat some more and you'll be okay, or just like don't be sick after you've eaten and you'll be fine. And I think the same could be with other mental health. Well, just don't think that, and then like just stop those thoughts. And it's not really quite as simple as that, is it? Because I think if people could, then they wouldn't be in the place that they're in. So I wonder what you'd say to people who, you know, have people in their life, whether it's friends or family, who are, or even themselves, who are really struggling with these thoughts that maybe have come on from the pandemic or just been going on for a while. How do we help those people that are struggling to control their thoughts in their heads?
Yeah, so I think if you're someone who's struggling with your thinking, it's firstly like always go to the GP. Like I know right now services are so overstretched, but it's really, really important to make yourself known to your GP, because then when stuff does come up, yes, you'll be put on a waiting list, but something might come up and it's good just to have started that dialogue. I think in all situations, it's important to identify maybe one person that you can be really honest with about what's going on. And like, you don't have to tell them every single thing, but for me, it was always a very factual thing. So like, kind of saying like, I'm aware that maybe this behavior is creeping back in. I'm feeling like this. I've been feeling like this for a long time. This is how much I'm thinking about food. If I don't exercise, I feel like this. And if you just start to name some of that stuff, then actually you can then work out how that person can best support you. I think so often with mental health issues, it's like people do really want to fix people. And I'm a massive fixer. So I know that I have a tendency to kind of jump straight in when someone tells me an issue. And I'm like, well, have you thought about this, this, this? Like, this is what you can do. This is how you can do it. But I think sometimes what we want is we want someone to not fix us. We don't want any sympathy. We just want someone to kind of be walking alongside us, doing it with us, and kind of distracting us after mealtimes if it's an eating disorder related issue, or making sure that activities are really, really varied. Helping people to create those really happy memories. And I think like a regular check-in is really, really important. I think particularly with eating disorders, we seem to judge the state of someone's mental health based on what their body looks like. And I know for me, like it meant that when I started recovering and my weight started to go up, like physically my body was changing, but mentally there was so much more work that needed to happen. And I needed people to be reminding me, I know you're not okay, even though you look healthy. I know you're not okay, even though you're eating. And I think bringing all of those conversations kind of into the open is just so important. And what I always say is like, we don't like have to be an expert to talk about this sort of stuff. Like, I think we shy away from talking about mental health issues and eating disorders because there is so much stigma and we're scared of getting it wrong. We're scared of upsetting people. But I do think that if we just start to show some of that vulnerability, then you not only help yourself, but you probably start helping others as well and create like a much better support network around you. And for me, that is just the crucial part of it. Like, we need to stop waiting for people to hit crisis point before people start to actually share what's going on. And for me now, I'm in a space where like, if I'm having a challenging day, I'll just like say to my other half, I'll be like, oh, I'm feeling a bit rubbish today. And he doesn't try and fix it. He doesn't try and jump straight in. And sometimes he'll be like, oh, what do you think's caused it? And I'm like, I don't know. But actually, just by telling someone, I think for me, it's that starting point that really helps to just kind of remove some of that pressure, I guess, on kind of like the pressure cooker that we all have going on inside of us.
I guess that stops it from also being kind of hidden as well, doesn't it? It gets it out there.
Yeah, and I think there are just too many people suffering at the moment. I know, so I've been going, like I do a lot of work in schools, and recently been kind of going back in face to face. And even just this week, I was in a school on Monday and I was getting them to do this like activity where they shut their eyes and kind of put their hand up, like to think about who they talk to, who they don't talk to, all of that sort of stuff. And in like groups of like, I don't know, 60 to 100 kids, you've got one kid who feels like they can honestly talk to someone about what's going on. And so the majority of people at the moment are just kind of sitting back and just feeling like what they're going through doesn't matter. And although I think it, like, obviously it does probably affect guys differently than girls, I do also think that being a female, like there's this expectation that we all sit around and we cry and we talk about our feelings and our emotions. But actually that is so, so wrong. Like often we're trying to hold everything together for everyone else. So I think it is like, even checking in on your kind of stronger friends, those people that maybe look like they have it all together, is just as important as checking in on those people who are showing that they're struggling.
And so for you, you had that year, going, so I want to go back to your story, you had that year as an inpatient, and then since then, has that been a kind of smooth ride of recovery? What's it been like?
I wish the answer was yes, but no. So when I left treatment, I was really institutionalized. So I kind of stuck very religiously to kind of my meal plan, and then kind of started to get to a better space. I went traveling for a year, which I think really, really helped, actually, just like the lack of structure. But then in 2016, I relapsed. I'm going to say I didn't relapse very badly, which whenever anyone else says that, I'm like, do not say that. But I was able to kind of notice it quite quickly in myself. And I ended up reaching out for support. But because I wasn't underweight, I wasn't able to access any sort of treatment at the time. And I remember at that appointment just feeling so misunderstood, so unheard, and had like this 4-week period where life was just really difficult. I cried a lot of the time. I was trying to work, kind of trying to just pretend like I was okay. And after feeling quite suicidal a number of times, my GP put me on antidepressants, which was something for me I was categorically against going on at the start. In all honesty, again, I think there's a lot of stigma and shame around antidepressants. But I ended up going on it for about 4 years. So I came off it right at the start of the pandemic, which was not planned. Yeah. But I'd kind of factored in that I was ready to come off it. So, and had started reducing my dose before we went into lockdown. So I think my brain would have probably been overwhelmed if I suddenly went back on it properly. But ever since then, I think I've been in a bit of an ongoing state. I made a lot of mistakes in my recovery. So I still had food rules. I was still scared about stuff. I probably relied too much on exercise as a coping mechanism. But I do believe that people can make a full recovery. I know statistically, I think statistically only 50% of people make a full recovery. But I know that I can do it. And I think just over the last year for me, I've had like a real assessment with myself, with my brain, with my body, with everything like that. And I'm now in a space where I'm really, really pushing for like that final bit. And I think I've just had to have worked through a lot. I became a Christian about a year and a half ago and was really angry that I wasn't like healed or anything like that. So for me, it's just been like an ongoing process and an ongoing journey, which I've now started to accept. I'm in an acceptance day today. Probably like 4 days ago, I wasn't, but I think that's the kind of where I'm at with it. Yeah.
Yeah. That's one thing I would love to ask you, because I was actually talking to someone yesterday saying there's this sort of thing of often as Christians, you know, if you pray, God will sort of sort it all out and God has this perfect plan for your life. And then when something's really difficult, you're like, well, where's the perfect plan? I've prayed and it hasn't gone. And I think particularly with mental health and faith, it can be really complicated. Like, I actually really struggled with my mental health in the pandemic, which I hadn't before. And I found it really difficult because I found that some people were like, well, just pray and it will all be okay. It's like, I am praying and it's not all okay. So how have you kind of managed that?
Yeah, it's been hard in places, in all honesty. So when I became a Christian, I thought I was going to be healed immediately. I don't know why I thought that, but I did. And I think you hear a lot of those. We always hear those stories of like the amazing healings. And we don't often hear the stories of people who are kind of living with stuff on a day-to-day basis. So I put a lot of pressure on myself with that. But I ended up, after kind of struggling with it for a couple of months, just trying to be really honest with God about it and like venting a lot, kind of talking it through. And I think like thinking about, actually, do you know what can I do to try and get myself to a better space with the help of God? So I know that on really, really difficult days, I know that I pray more. I listen to a lot of podcasts. I listen to a lot of worship music, even if I'm really, really angry and frustrated that I'm not totally healed. And I think that's what keeps me going through those times and through those kind of more challenging areas, I think. And I think as well, like something that I'm trying to do at the moment is, and I guess linking into all the affirmations and stuff, actually just reminding myself that actually, like, God loves me, like, I'm amazing, like, all of that sort of stuff. And I think as well, like as individuals and particularly like as Christians, like we can find so much joy in like the journey of recovery. Mm-hmm. And the more we kind of look for those moments, the more we kind of focus our eyes on God and not kind of become so fixated on our own issues and our own problems, then actually I think that really helps. But it's hard. And I've cried about it. I've shouted about it. I've probably asked about a million questions about why I haven't been healed and what's the matter with me and do I not have enough faith and all of that sort of stuff. But for me, it is just, yeah, kind of, I guess, accepting it and just kind of keeping pressing into it. And I do believe that some people will be like, can be healed. I really, really believe that. And I think some people live with it and that's also okay. But it's like, I think, yeah, kind of realizing that, I think, kind of helped to just alleviate some of that. And I also think with mental health issues, like you can find that healing in other things, like whether it is through therapy or kind of looking at stuff around you as well.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I would believe like God is in that, you know, whether you find through like nature and doing things outdoors, that kind of brings extra sort of comfort and support. But God created that. So it doesn't have to happen in one specific way. And actually therapy is amazing. Like medication is amazing. There's so much stuff that we can believe is all part of God's creation, but we don't, it might not necessarily be this sort of nice route of like we go and we get prayed for and then everything's okay. I wish it was always like that. But I don't know if it is, it's very rare. And if it is for that thing, there's other stuff, because life is just not quite as straight path as we would like it to be.
Yeah, it's true. And I think you learn so much along the way. I know, like for me, like I probably spent a lot of time trying to bargain with God. And I was like, right, if you make me better, then I'll do this and I'll do this and I'll do this. So I think like I don't do that anymore. But I think that was quite a learning curve, I think, as well. And like, I guess just realizing that. And actually, it was interesting. I listened over the pandemic to a podcast by Christine Kane. And it was really interesting because she was talking about how basically kind of telling people to just get up and walk. So get up off the mat, I think it was called, or something like that. And I was kind of thinking, like, I think so often in life when you have a mental health issue, you can get into this really victim mentality around it. And because it's not a choice, like you don't always feel like it's your fault. But I know for me, like I was slipping into that victim mentality when God hadn't healed me. And I was like feeling really super sorry for myself. I was like, this is ridiculous. Like I was angry. I was upset. And because of that, I was just really starting to kind of like withdraw a lot, like not just like in my work, but also kind of like publicly was like, I don't really want to do anything. I'm so annoyed and I'm the victim in all of this. But I think at some point as individuals, you have to kind of make that choice to kind of step forward into like that victory moment and realizing that actually, do you know what? Like my victory might not be that I'm ever fully recovered, but it's about me stepping forward into that victory, knowing that every single day I can get through the day. I can challenge myself with food. I'm not going to let it hold me back. And that God's with me through that. And I think as soon as I started to kind of realize that I had this real like shift in my head, but it took me a long time to get to that point as well.
How did you become a Christian? How did you find faith again?
I did it on Alpha, actually. I was having a really bad summer. And it was like around all kind of like the court case and everything was concluding. Mm. And I was finding life really, really difficult again. And I've been struggling for quite a long time, not with food again, but my coping mechanism at that point was basically to just work 24/7 and like really focus on fixing everyone else and campaigning and stuff like that. And my godmother actually told me to go. And so I was like, kind of umming and ahhing, wasn't really sure if I wanted to, but basically ended up going because I was kind of annoyed that she kept nagging me to go. And she wasn't nagging me. She was doing it in a really loving way, but I just was like, oh, like I'm going to just have to go. I did that and ended up becoming Christian on the Alpha course, but I didn't think I was going to. I actually went in and definitely in the first kind of couple of weeks was like quite standoffish, was quite opinionated about, well, very opinionated about everything, was probably quite argumentative because I just was so frustrated by the whole thing. But over that kind of time, I had a lot of time to process and a lot of time to just work out what I believed and what I didn't believe. And I think, like, I grew up in a Christian family, so I had that kind of base level of understanding, I thought. But for me, what shifted on that course, I think, was I realized that it's not about religion, so to speak. It's like a faith. It's about that relationship with God. And that's what I really, really wanted. So I think just having that space to ask a lot of those difficult questions and to be heard within that really, really helped.
And I know you do a lot of campaigning, but I wondered what you would say to, like, one, sort of society, what we need to do, but two, also to the church, like, are there things that people with faith could do differently that would help people with anorexia and eating disorders?
Yeah, you know? So I think on, like, a society level, it's like we need to be bringing these conversations out into the open, and we need to be okay talking about eating disorders and exercise dependency and kind of general disordered eating, and to not shy away from that. We are currently living in a world where there is just this epidemic of eating disorders, and unless we really start talking about it, people are going to keep dying. And I think that we all have a duty of responsibility to do that and to create those spaces where people can, yeah, have that space to talk about what's actually going on. And I think from, like, a church perspective, one of my things that I struggle with church is that often every single event happens around a meal time or around food. And I know that right now I probably am in a space where I could do that, but definitely when I first became a Christian, I couldn't. And it meant that actually I really struggled to meet any other people, because I didn't want to hang around after church because there was a pizza and someone might ask why I wasn't having anything or what was going on. And even, like, things like, kind of, I guess, evening groups as well, like, they always happen over a meal time. So if you're someone who's in recovery and you've got a meal plan, it's like, well, how can I go to that? Because I can't go because it interrupts. Yeah. So I think for me, like, there's something around actually looking at what we can do to become, I guess, become a space where people with eating disorders can show up and know that they don't have to have something to eat, or that maybe it doesn't happen at a meal time or something like that. And I think it's hard because obviously people really connect over food. But I do think we need to be thinking a little bit like that. And whether that is kind of providing menus beforehand or being really clear around what the food's going to be, again, that would kind of help that shift, I think, mentally for individuals to show up. But I think also, like, when you are in church, like, when you're praying for someone or someone comes forward for prayer or whatever it might be, like, don't assume that they're coming forward because they want to be prayed for to be healed from their eating disorder. Like, they've probably got a load of other stuff going on. And that goes for every single type of mental health issue. Like, don't just look at that person and see the illness. Like, they might want to pray about something else. And I think being really open to that as well is really, really important. And I think the final thing, it's like kind of thinking, I think it's thinking about, like, a lot of the messaging that's out there at the moment. And I'm not kind of theologically trained, but I do know that from the work that I've done with a lot of youth groups over the last year, particularly, there are a lot of young people, but also adults as well, who are really struggling with their body image, and people who maybe are struggling with calorie counting or obsessive exercise. And yes, on the outside, it might look like they're kind of idolizing, like, their body or idolizing exercise, but actually they've got a mental health issue. And because we're framing it quite often in such a way, it means that people are still living with a lot of that shame and that guilt. So I think as individuals, it's like checking in and making sure that if we are talking about things like that, actually maybe there's a follow up in place afterwards with individuals, or giving them that space to really emphasize that.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. It's the bigger thing, right? People don't need extra judgment. All they need is people to come alongside them. And actually, if there's more sort of judgment or being told that you need to do things in a certain way, I think it's just going to push people away, really, isn't it? Because that's not what they want. And part of why I've done this podcast, I think if we have faith and we want to be like Jesus, we should be so loving and compassionate and kind towards others that people should feel more welcome and at ease and supported and known, rather than feeling like I've got to be a certain way. If I'm not that way, I'm going to be judged, or I'm going to be prayed for. But if I'm not healed, then I'm going to be judged, you know, if I haven't done a certain thing. And I think there can be a lot of pressure in that there might not necessarily, you might not necessarily feel without faith, that you've got to be kind of this perfect person with your faith makes you all okay. And yeah. I think how you've described it is, it's like God alongside us, but it doesn't mean we've got everything right, because no one's got it right and everyone has their struggles. And I guess it's how we support people and make people feel loved and accepted, and not necessarily that we can't pray for healing, but we don't necessarily force that on people unless that's what they want prayer for. And if they're not prayed, then we don't think it's their fault or our fault that we haven't prayed the right prayer.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
I don't think that's how God works. Yeah. I think I've got to say the right words and then it will all be great. But I don't think that's how it works, luckily, actually. Yeah. Otherwise, it's too much pressure on us.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think you're so right. It is about, yeah, finding those ways to love people in the moment. I remember actually just on the Alpha course, actually, I was really nervous about the food that was going to be there in the evening, and kind of got through the first week, but found the whole thing quite stressful. But actually then Jemima, who was one of the people kind of leading the group I was in, she would often text me on the morning and be like, this is what's on the menu this evening, like just to kind of give me the heads up. And it's those really small things that feel like a really tiny, pointless thing for the individual to be doing, but actually as someone who's in recovery and someone who maybe struggles with that a little bit, like actually having that just messaged me made it so much easier, because I didn't have to then message and be like, oh, what's on the meal tonight kind of thing. So I think just opening up that conversation a little bit more and just being bold like that as well.
And I guess part of it is being open to talk about it and confront it with other people and not feeling uncomfortable. I guess that's part of it as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. Like we talk about, I was thinking about this actually randomly yesterday, it was like, when we talk about COVID-19, we've basically brought into our kind of vocabulary a load of words from a pandemic that we never knew before. And it's like, so we've done it this quickly, we should be able to also do it for things like eating disorders and bring in a load of vocabulary that a lot of us probably were nervous about saying at the start, but now we're all fine saying it. And I think that's like probably like a wider society educational piece. But I do think that as individuals, again, it's like we can try and equip ourselves to actually, yeah, to start to just be more okay talking about it and realizing that, yes, we will get it wrong at times. We'll probably mess it up. We might say something that's offensive, but actually there's no harm in trying. And I think it's better to be offensive and get it wrong than to just kind of push it under the carpet and not say anything.
What are the things to like totally avoid if you're with someone who's got some sort of eating disorder?
So anything number related, so kind of calories, anything like that. Talking about specific weights is really bad. Something that really bothers me, and it probably sounds again really silly, but whenever anyone says to me, you look really healthy, I'm like, oh, like, what does that mean? Does that mean that I've put on weight? Does that mean this? And my brain literally will like completely twist that word. So avoiding kind of things like that is really, really important. And I think as well, like avoiding saying things like, oh, like you look okay now, everything must be fine. So just, I think, focusing less on the person's image and maybe kind of focusing a little bit more on like how they're doing and things like that. And I think a positive to say, and something that I really love, is when people comment on like how much energy I've got or how I'm more engaged or how I'm kind of glowing a little bit more and just got a bit more colour back in my face. And I think, again, it's those really, really nice kind of, I guess they are compliments, but those really nice things that shows that actually, do you know what? It's working, like something is changing in you. And yeah, focusing, I think, more on that sort of stuff, I guess, than the other bits.
Mm. Yeah, that's really helpful. And one question that I always like to ask everyone on the podcast is, if you were to sort of say what the greatest inequality you see in the world right now, what would you say that is? Sort of an injustice inequality that you see?
So for me, it's that people cannot access treatment and support when they really, really need it. I think I do think it's a complete injustice that right now people are dying because there isn't support out there. And with eating disorders, particularly, like we're seeing that on a day-to-day basis, every 62 minutes, someone dies of an eating disorder. Mm-hmm. And like, it's 2021, like people shouldn't be dying of this sort of stuff. We know with the right treatment, with the right interventions, with the right prevention, like that can stop. And for me, it's an injustice, partly because it's obviously causing a lot of deaths, but also because there is stuff that we can concretely do to actually change that now and make it better for others. And it's just been left too long like this. And we need to start really, really challenging and kind of championing people to start speaking up about it to make sure that we can have that equal access to services.
Wow, yeah, that's so interesting. It's so awful how the impact that it's having. I guess that's what your campaign, Dump the Scales, is all about, isn't it? Getting people access without them having to look a certain size.
Yeah, and I think the hard thing at the moment is I feel like, and I'm probably going to go off on a massive vent, but I feel like we're hiding behind a pandemic. We're like blaming the pandemic for everything. And I'm like, do you know what? This was happening before. Mm. But what has happened is now like a systematic issue with services, and an overrun service is now something that's been completely kind of broken and brought to its knees. And there's just not enough stuff out. There's not enough funding. There's not enough workforce. And there's just this still this lack of understanding. I think particularly around adult services, people still have that kind of idea that you just grow out of an eating disorder and you're just going to be okay if you get a bit older or if you get married or if you get a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And you're like, actually, it's not that straightforward. So I think for me, it's a constant feels like a constant battle at the moment to get people to realise the severity of it. But yeah, Dump the Scales is all around trying to change that. So looking at education, looking at kind of frontline staff, making sure people are really, really equipped, but also challenging a lot of that kind of stigma and assumptions around eating disorders.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much, Hope. It's amazing what you're doing, and it's so interesting to hear all that and so helpful and to understand a bit more about that. So thank you so much, and thank you for sharing your own story as well.
That's right. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to this podcast, Conversations on Faith and Quality, with me, Bex Dillon, and my guest today, Hope Virgo. It's been so great to hear from Hope and try to understand a bit more about eating disorders, about the gravity of the problems of eating disorders that there are, but also to understand it from her life, her reality. And in hearing someone's story, I just always find that it gives you a much greater insight to what it's like to live with something like anorexia. And so I hope that people who have listened to this feel both a greater understanding of eating disorders, but also hopefully feel encouraged that there is help available for people that are struggling, that there are ways to recover. And so for anyone listening to this who is struggling, or anyone who knows other people that are struggling, please do reach out for help, because it's so important to get help. And I think, as Hope said, that a thing that I loved that she said was God being with her through this, but also talking about the ways that God can work to bring that help, whether it's through medication, through doctors, through services, through the NHS. So please don't let this be something that you struggle with alone, or you see people struggle with alone. Please always reach out and get help. Thank you for listening to this, and please tell your friends about it. Please comment, leave a review. I'd love to hear your feedback. And if you haven't subscribed already, please subscribe, because we have more episodes coming soon. Thanks so much for listening.